Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right. Well, you can hear him on the hockey show here on UMFM, but thrilled to have Jason Pajak here on Turning Pages to discuss his new novel, Bounty, which takes place in a Winnipeg 100 years in the future, which I should add does have hockey in it. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So is that the hockey, is that like one for you? Like you put that little element in that, like, yes, there's still hockey. I have hope.
Yes, exactly. It was not a last minute inclusion, but it was something that I wanted to fit in there because, I mean, a lot of the impetus behind some of the inclusions in the book was to show that in a future where we have kind of dealt with climate disaster in whatever way we can, a lot of the creature comforts of life don't have to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, well, hockey's, and you know, it's set in Winnipeg and Manitoba, so obviously hockey's going to be a big thing in there. I also snuck in a Formula One reference as well, so that's kicking around too. But yeah, right, definitely for me.
Generations of Hamiltons, I think, are still.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're still driving race cars.
There you go. So in terms of motivations, you talk in the acknowledgments about, you know, growing up, having, you know, limited access to movies and TV in a cottage and having a lot of books, that you wanted to write your own book. And I do want to ask you about kind of like your reading habits and how they maybe informed this first book, because there's Greek mythology, there's Norse mythology. Like, are these things that you read as a kid that filtered into this book, or is that independent of what you read?
It's definitely part of it. You know, because growing up, you know, I grew up in the heyday of really when fantasy and then kind of YA started to really take off. But it was never totally my cup of tea. You know, I love Lord of the Rings and things like that. But science fiction was always what I was focused on. And through that, I think I've learned a lot of things and read a lot of things, but the one kind of constant that has followed me throughout like my childhood and now into my adulthood has been my interest in history, and particularly, you know, ancient Greek history. My name is shared with one of the great, you know, historical or mythological figures of ancient Greece. So I obviously had some interest in that growing up, but yeah, it was one of those things where I did have a lot of interest in all of that stuff growing up, and it's always been sitting in the back of my mind because I've been so interested in the way that mythology is used and utilized, and particularly as I've gotten older and, you know, taking courses in university in, you know, classics about, you know, the role of mythology and the role that it plays in society and building values and being the stories that we tell ourselves. I wanted to bring that in to this particular story, but it's always been something that I've had a particular affinity for, and I've always been obsessed with the way that mythology and stories are used to tell, you know, to portray the values of the time and tell the stories of the time in a very interesting way.
So was it purposeful to bring in Norse and Greek mythology to tie it into that myth making and how we tell stories, or what, like, did you ever have any hesitation about that in terms of building your own stories and your own myths?
I don't know if I particularly had any reservations about it. I think, and it's something that I think every writer grapples with at different times, is wanting to stand on your own and, you know, either chart a new path or get as far away from things that already exist that you can be certain that you're not going to be compared to anybody, or you can be have something that's totally your own. But really what I did was, it wasn't intentional to really bring in that whole myth making aspect, but it definitely was used as kind of a wink and a nod and a guide for me to be able to tell the story that I wanted to tell. Because, you know, the whole Norse and Greek and the presence of gods feeds into the story in a very interesting way. And obviously that changed over various drafts of the story and iterations of the actual mythology behind that, like, kind of undergirds the story itself. But the inclusion was very much as a way to bring something textual into the novel in a really real way. You know, it's something that, you know, it's this world where I'm throwing a lot of, you know, techno babble at people, I'm throwing a lot of science at people, and you're trying to get up to speed with society as it is, and the science and the sociology and psychology and politics that shape that society. So giving people things that they can latch onto and be like, oh, I know about the myth of Prometheus. I know about, you know, Poseidon and Triton and all of these Greek and Roman gods. I can, that's one, a little bit of less mental energy that I have to spend thinking about this thing, rather than coming up with something wholly new.
You mentioned technobabble, and I did want to ask you, in terms of building out a, like, an imaginary world, I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. It's not imaginary in the sense that, like, it's set in a real world. It's set in Winnipeg, yeah. But 100 years in the future, and sort of imagining what that will be and what look like. Mm-hmm. How tied are you, or, like, what kind of difficulties do you have to go through to, like, explain that world and the, like, the shape and the rules? Like, do you ever mm-hmm. get kind of bogged down in the minutia of it and feel that?
Oh, totally.
Oh man, totally. Like, I want to describe this, but I don't want to, like, lose the plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's something that, you know, because you do multiple drafts, and there was a draft that was 500 pages long.
Mm.
And I was very cognizant about the fact that I didn't want to over-explain things. I didn't, you know, I never want to treat the audience as stupid and have to, like, over-explain absolutely every minute detail. I want to leave, you know, I trust that the reader can kind of piece things together themselves, or they can come up with an explanation or something that makes it make sense in their head for a lot of things. Like, obviously there are certain aspects to the science and the structure of the world that has to be explained for it to all make sense and to really get the sense of where the world is at and where society is at and the science is at. But yeah, there was quite a few times where I was sitting there writing explanations of pieces of the technology. I'm like, do I really need to go this in depth with how this works? And I'm still struggling with that, because I've been writing the sequel to the book over the last, you know, year and a bit. Mm-hmm. And there are particular scenes where I'm like, this is stuff that I haven't explained before and it's new. And am I going too deep? Because yeah, you don't want to lose the plot, lose the flow of the story, and get things bogged down in a lot of the science. So it was really about what is kind of like the minimum viable product for getting this idea across, or showing it rather than going into this long explanation.
So then what is the, like, measure of that level of getting things across that's explicable to the reader? Like, if you're, because you said, you know, it's about 300, just over 300 pages, you excised, you know, like two-fifths roughly. Mm-hmm. How do you carve that down, and, like, who, like, is it yourself judging that, or do you have an editor who's helping you with, like, determining, like, okay, this makes sense without being too detailed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, part of it's me and part of it is my editor. She was fantastic about, you know, pointing out the areas where I didn't explain things enough and areas where I kind of over-explained. You know, because I'm coming at it from the perspective of, I know the ins and outs of this world. I know every detail possible. I've thought quite a lot about it. So having an external perspective, seeing things for the first time or the second or third time, really helped me kind of hone it in and say, okay, the depth of this explanation does not need to happen. There were things that, you know, I was explaining concepts up until, like, the final chapters of the book, and, you know, getting to a point where it's like, all right, do I exactly need to explain the, you know, the details of how a robot can feel, or do I just kind of leave it up to, I've explained it in kind of a roundabout way over here, and it kind of just fits the scene better to not go into this diatribe about how does, you know, a completely synthetic being have the very human sensation. And I think the balance that I had to strike was, does a reader kind of passing, you know, Stephen King talks about in his book on writing about, you know, the first draft you write with the door closed, you write for yourself. And the second draft you write with the door open and you write with the reader in mind and what they're going to see and what they're going to understand when they're going through this. And I needed to ask myself while I'm going through this, is this something that is going to offer some kind of explanation or a detail to the reader that helps them get grounded in the world more? Or is it just something extraneous that they're not going to care about and it doesn't serve the story? Because ultimately, the story is what matters. The nitty-gritty of the science, while it is important in a lot of respects, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, as long as they kind of get to the point of it. Like the worst thing to happen to Star Wars, or one of the worst things to happen to Star Wars, is when they tried to explain how the Force works. And you just kind of just leave it at, it's this magical energy field that keeps things together. And it's really, you know, spiritual and whatever. Don't talk to me about midichlorians and, you know, the percentage of whatever DNA you need to be a Jedi or whatever. Just tell me enough so I get that this thing exists, a little bit of how it works, and we can move on.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring up Star Wars, because as you were talking, I was thinking about like how, you know, we didn't necessarily need like taxation systems in mm-hmm. the Republic. Like that was like one of the, you know, like,
yes,
like for someone who's built a world in their head, like obviously mm-hmm. it's very important to them to like have it all solved. But, mm-hmm. you know, at a certain point when you're telling a story, like people can get like lost in the minutiae. And I have to imagine that's that like bridge from the like opening the door. Like, how much do I tell you when you're writing it with the door closed, though? I have to ask, like, are you writing with like Nikos, your central character first? Or are you thinking about like what Winnipeg in 2100s looks like? Like what are you first latching on to drive this story for yourself?
For myself, you know, I tend to, when I come up with stories, I think of the narrative itself as kind of the primary driver. I'm very much of the camp of the story will tell itself. You just need to sit down and start writing it. That's what that first draft is all about. And then the second kind of draft and the second thing that I think of is how does the character fit into that narrative, and what do they think about what's going on, and what do they feel, and how are they interacting? Like, what's the most realistic reaction that they're going to have moment to moment in things that are going along? So I think Nikos is kind of like the first layer is the narrative layer. And then the second layer is the Nikos layer, where, you know, any scene that he's in, okay, he's there in the scene. What's he looking at? What's he thinking about? How does he feel about the things that are going on? What's his plan for the next 5-10 steps? And then the final layer is, how does the world around him frame what's going on? And how does what's going on fit into this kind of ecosystem of the world that I'm creating? Because a lot of the pieces really started to shape themselves to suit the narrative that was going along. There were components to the different factions that exist in the world. You know, I didn't have all of the factions laid out at the start when I started writing. You know, I had no factions when I started writing the book. Those kind of just popped up as things went along. And the world really took shape more as the narrative went on. Like, I had this idea that, okay, what's Winnipeg going to look like? You know, to I have always thought about, like, oh yeah, every science fiction story, you know, everyone starts building up towards the sky, like the Jetsons, like Coruscant, like all of these, you know, Night City in Cyberpunk 2077, like every city builds up. What if we built down? How would that work? What would that look like? What would that feel like? So yeah, I think to answer your question in a very roundabout way, I think while writing, it's kind of the narrative first and foremost, then the character.
So that decision to build down, I mean, it comes apart in response to like climate, that, you know, like geothermal heating and things like that, that like Winnipeg would not necessarily go upwards, right? With winds and things like that. I guess I've read cli-fi without knowing or hearing it being called cli-fi, but essentially it's like climate science fiction.
Yep.
Was that something that you had read a lot of, or like wanted to go into, or was it just a necessity of like, if I'm going to think about a world 100 years from now and I'm being honest about like science, this is what's happening?
It's definitely more of the latter. So when I originally wrote, when I wrote that first couple drafts, it was a very stereotypical cyberpunk story. You know, my background is in sociology. I've studied a lot on inequality and public policy and things like that. So the narrative was really shaped by my understanding of the world. Like the question that I asked myself when I did start writing the book was, okay, if we continue on into the future in the next 100 years with the way that our politics works, this kind of neoliberal economic policy, what's the world going to look like and feel like? Like what's something that is fantastical enough that it's interesting, but grounded enough that it makes sense with the trajectory that we're on? So I wrote this kind of cyberpunk story about bounty hunters in, you know, future Winnipeg. But there were always these pieces peppered throughout as I was thinking, and it definitely more of that latter piece where I couldn't imagine a world 100 years in the future, or even like 20, 30 years in the future, without climate change and the impacts of climate disaster being a central piece of how we developed as a society, and how our society, our civilization, how our cities, how our science and technology and politics all developed. And it was very early on, I got to say, like maybe the second draft, you know, some of the initial conversations that I had with my editor, and, you know, she broached the idea of like, there's a lot to this narrative that suits climate fiction. Because I'd never heard of climate fiction until she brought it up. And then I started looking into it and I was like, wow, like kind of like you had said, like, I've read a lot of climate fiction without really knowing it. And I was like, okay, I think this fits. Like I can definitely see this working. And as subsequent drafts rolled along, I realized, oh, this is like really good material and a really good framing for the world, because I firmly believe that climate disaster and climate change are so intrinsic to the future we're going to see. All science fiction, all cyberpunk fiction moving forward will be impossible to disentangle from climate change in any way. It's like climate fiction and cyberpunk fiction are going to fuse together out of necessity moving forward. Because you think about, you know, all of the popular explanations of cyberpunk futures, it's all these mega cities, you know, think of, you know, Dread, think of Cyberpunk 2077, think of Neuromancer, Blade Runner. It's all these mega cities where you go outside and it's desolate wastelands that have been rocked by ecological collapse, and, you know, framed very much in, you know, it's the advance of technology that has sapped the world of all of its natural resources and thrown us into disarray. But now with our current understanding of where climate change is going and how we are in the era of climate change already, it's going to be impossible to look towards the future and not have that in mind for how things are going to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You mentioned, you know, the like extrapolating from our neoliberal kind of corporate world of now, you have a company that, let's not say it solves climate change, but addresses climate change.
Yes.
With a technological innovation, and, you know, that they're then given kind of license to take over. And like, it does seem like kind of like this natural extension of like, if companies are the ones that got us into this, they're going to need to be the ones to get us out of it, right? Like, in the same way that like people argue, but like, you know, it's great that individuals compost and recycle, but like, we're not the ones producing.
We're not making a dent in carbon emissions.
Right.
Yeah.
Was that part of kind of like when you were kind of extrapolating that that would likely have to happen if there was going to be a solve?
Not exactly that it has to happen. I think that it's a natural outcome. Like, it's something that we're already seeing today. Not a lot of people know this, but the oil and gas industry in Canada is currently lobbying the federal government to provide public taxpayer funds to these private corporations to invest in green energy. They're not doing it to suit the needs of society or doing it out of the goodness of their own heart. They're, you know, it's a goal of the government. You want to keep these, you know, big billion-dollar corporations running, and they know that the clock is ticking in terms of climate change. They want to get goodwill back from society. So they are working with the government to throw our money at their innovations and their developments. So it's a way that, you know, same with how, you know, subsequent, you know, our governments have been throwing public funds and selling off parts of our healthcare industry and our education to different companies. It's another piece of where they're going to be out of necessity and out of just a natural progression of business and technology, and particularly the energy sector. It's a natural outcome of neoliberal policy that this is just going to be another thing that gets privatized and sold off to the highest bidder. And it's going to be, you know, it's these companies aren't really doing it. They say they're doing it out of the goodness of their own heart, but they're really doing it with a financial incentive in mind. You know, they want to be the first one there. They want to get, you know, up and running, and they want to do it in the cheapest way possible. How do you do that? You take money from the government, straight from the taxpayers, and throw it into building wind farms and solar panels and all of these other things. So I hasten to say that it's companies necessarily turning back and saying, oh no, we're doing this horrible stuff to the planet. It's more like, all right, we can do this thing that the people want us to do in the cheapest way possible to get that goodwill and also ensure that our business can proliferate moving forward when the tap runs out for oil and gas.
Your central character, Nikos, you know, belonged to a family that was part of this corporation in the book. Mm-hmm. Was it important or like necessary for him to have always been part of that like lineage and then kind of like at a remove from it? Was that like, did you ever consider Nikos being kind of just like a regular bounty hunter?
Yeah, I definitely considered it. And I think it was partly because, you know, to have him more directly tied emotionally to what was going on, and to have a bit of a better insider look to what the inner workings of the company were, just to show that, like, again, to show that this is a heartless corporation. They will literally cut bait and throw out members of one of the founding families of the organization if it financially suits them, or if it suits their goals as individuals running the company. So it was, I did consider at times thinking, okay, maybe I can just make him, you know, this average person. But on the one hand, I wanted to show that even people who are at the top and are from these like greedy lineages can change and can see the error of the past and try and do things better moving forward. But then also we have other characters in the narrative that suit that role as well, as being kind of the common person who is in acting in response to this world, and we can see their perspective alongside Nikos's perspective. So he has the insider look, and we get to see the inner workings of the company through him and get the context and history through him. We also get, you know, with Maria and Mac, the average person's view of what this world is like and the impact that it has on them.
Right. Now, I mean, we've talked a lot of heady stuff. There's a lot of action in this book. Was it difficult to write action scenes and like describe what's happening? Like, are you picturing it in your head and then having mm-hmm. to like work out how do I describe the action that's going on? Or is that like an easier thing than, you know, building a world?
Honestly, writing action is the easiest part for me. I, for a long time, struggled. The thing that I struggled with was dialogue. I never thought that the dialogue that I would write would ever be impactful or interesting. So I was like terrified of ever having full chapters where it's nothing but dialogue and nothing but conversations. Eventually, you know, I got over that and have full chapters where nothing action-wise happens, but it's still emotional impactful. Action for me was always the easiest part. And I always thought of it as I'm writing from the perspective of like the camera, right? The words that I'm putting down are the explanations for what is happening in front of the camera, which is the reader's mind at this time. And, you know, getting into the nitty-gritty details of how bodies move in space and how the environment reacts and the sights and sounds of things going around them. It was always the part that I enjoyed the most and the part that I thought was that I was best at. And I always felt like I wanted to write something that felt like a movie while you're reading it. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see, like, understand, like, even, you know, in my mind while I'm writing the book and the action scenes, I'm thinking in the mind of a cinema camera and like, what way is the camera going to pan or move around the scene or cut from perspective to perspective in the most interesting way possible? And I hope that I got that across, because I have a pretty good idea of how these scenes look, and I think it looks pretty cool, but hopefully for people reading, they get the same.
For sure. You alluded to it that you're already working on a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like, will that be the end of like the bounty tale, or like, is this something where you feel like there's, you know, like an indefinite window to like how long mm-hmm. you could go through this story?
Oh, I have so many plans.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the sequel is definitely, it's kind of a direct follow-up to this story. And then I have also, you know, I finished the first draft. Actually, I guess we call it the second draft of the sequel. And I've been working a little bit on the third book. But I have plans for prequel novels, for spinoffs, for like, I want to explore, you know, the history of, you know, all of the other characters. I want it to show where Mac and Trapper come from. I want to show Nikos's time working as a soldier in a paramilitary. And I have scenes, like full scenes that used to be in Bounty that I took out to save time and space, but are fully written. And I want to share those with people. So I definitely have a lot of plans for how this world can expand and this narrative can progress.
Well, folks will have to wait till you open the door on those particular writing exercises. But for now, they can get their hands on Bounty through Turnstone Press. Jason, congratulations on the release of the book, and thanks for taking some time to talk about it.
I'm always happy to talk.